You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
I'm Kelly Corrigan, and I'm here today to talk to Lori Gottlieb. So Lori and I have a few things in common. We both have a podcast. Mine is called Kelly Corrigan Wonders, and Lori's is called Dear Therapist. We have books out, so I am also a writer, and we also have the same agent. So I'm super happy to be with you. Hi.
Hi. Yes, so much in common, and I'm so happy to have this conversation.
So I thought you'd be such an interesting person to talk to. So over the years of your work as a therapist and as a columnist and as a podcaster, you have been on the receiving end of thousands of letters reaching out, asking for advice, and in particular around relationships. And so I wondered if over all that incoming information, you're noticing some patterns. So could we start with like a sense of the kinds of things that many people are experiencing in relationship that maybe we could all learn from?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to be able to kind of take the temperature of what's going on with people by looking in my inbox. Of course, as a therapist, I get to see people one-on-one, and I hear a lot about, you know, what might be going on. But I think that when you look at thousands of letters, you start to see patterns. And a lot of what I see is this central question, I think, which is, how can I love and be loved? And I say this even for people who are happily married, people who have familial love, who have platonic love. I think that we often get in our own way in relationships, in relationship to others, and also in relationship to ourselves. And so what I think people struggle with is getting out of their own way.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, I mean, I'm thinking about myself, but I'm also thinking about the few people in the world that I know well, namely my two kids, my husband, my family of origin. And for sure, there's a variety of ease with which people are able to love and be loved. And there are so many people that can only do one side of the equation that are very loving, but for whatever reason, aren't able to allow themselves to be known. And I know that Brené Brown has introduced to the common vernacular this idea of vulnerability. But how do you see that playing out in terms of people's ability to actually be loved, which involves the tremendously daring act of being known?
It really is a daring act to be known. I think in our culture today, we see a lot of posts on Instagram like, you know, I'm putting this out there for all of you, and I'm being very vulnerable, and people say, you were so brave. I'll tell you what the real act of bravery is. The real act of bravery is to sit face to face in the same space with someone where the stakes are really high, where you have an intimate relationship with this person. And intimate, again, doesn't have to be romantic. And you reveal something about yourself. That is true vulnerability. And I think that in our culture, we see vulnerability sometimes as a weakness. And I think especially for men, I will say, men especially, I think women too, but I see a difference. So in my therapy office, for example, men will come in and they'll say, I've never told anyone this before. And they literally have not told a soul. And women will come in and they'll say, you know, I've never told anyone this before, except for my mother, my sister, my best friend, right? So that person has told a few people, but it feels like she hasn't. And I think that there's this idea that a lot of men hold, which is that that to be strong, they have to take care of everything themselves. They have to be very self-sufficient, that they can love others and they can be supportive to others, like you were saying about one side of the equation. But it's hard for them to take in the love. And I think that they suffer as a result of it. And I think that women do too. I think we all suffer when we can't show the truth of who we are or reveal ourselves to other people, because you can't truly be loved if you aren't revealing yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes that we just had a funny thing happen in our house. So someone we adore, who my cousin, who has lived with us off and on over the years, hurt her neck. There's some kind of pinched nerve or something. And she said, I have noticed this funny pattern, which is when I tell women, my mom, you, my sister, oh my God, I'm in like level 10 pain, like I'm weeping in pain. she's a tough cookie. So for her to weep is big. That the women say, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry." Mm-hmm. And then when she says the exact same words to a man, her boyfriend or my husband or her dad, they say, "What did you do?"
Mm.
Like they right. want to explain it. They want to come up with like a thesis about how and when it happened. And that's some sort of comfort. Whereas the women just want to skip the hypothesizing about the moment this nerve got pinched and just hold.
Right.
And I was imagining socialized or yeah.
Yeah, I do. And I was imagining too, that maybe their response would be, and let me give you some suggestions on how, what you can do, like go to the chiropractor or here's a good doctor or, you know, cause they want to fix as opposed to just be present with. And I think that comes down to the way that we listen too, because I think that, you know, sometimes I think we don't know how to listen to the people who matter most to us, going back to that equation of love or being loved. So it's very loving. It's a very loving act to help someone to feel understood. I remember once in couples therapy, this couple was in and she was saying like, you know what three words would make me feel so good? And he said, "I love you." And she said, "No, the three words are, I understand you." I think that's what we all want. And so when somebody comes to you with something, it's a, you know, we never ask them or we rarely ask them, how can I be helpful to you in this conversation? Do you just want to vent right now because it's really raw and it just happened? Do you want a hug? Do you want my thoughts about this? Do you want my honest feedback? Do you want me to help problem solve with you? What would be helpful in this moment? And also knowing that maybe that's not the only conversation about it, that in that moment you might need one thing, but in another moment you could be asking for something completely different. But as listeners, we assume that how we would want to be helped in that moment is how the other person wants to be helped. And so often we're not really helping them, meaning we're not really listening to them because we're giving them something that we want versus something that they want.
You know, that's so funny because it goes to this little moment in my marriage. So I'm 20 years in now, and it only took about 3 years for us to sort of want to dismantle the golden rule, which is to say, treat others as you want to be treated. Because frankly, it's can be deeply misleading. Because the way
that's right.
I mean, what Edward would want in a moment might be to like skip all the feeling and get right to the problem solving. Or just to validate the crap out of him and be like, "You're right, that guy's crazy. You should have gotten that." But that doesn't mean that that's a good guide for what I want.
That's right. And I think, you know, we do that to our kids too, all the time as parents where, you know, we think, well, I'm wiser, I have a perspective on this, or it's just so uncomfortable for us to watch our kids struggle with something. And so it's really our discomfort that we're trying to get rid of. And we don't give them the space to kind of, you know, sit with and marinate in a little bit of discomfort that will help them to learn something or to grow as humans. And so when they come to us and they say, you know, "I didn't get the part in the school play," or, you know, "so-and-so didn't sit with me at lunch," or "here's what happened," we kind of jump in to try to make them feel better or offer them advice or whatever it is that would make us feel comfortable. But it's not necessarily what would be the right thing for them or what they really need in that moment. And again, when we talk about loving, I'm talking about all kinds of love, loving your children, loving your family members, loving your romantic partner, loving your friends. And also, I think the most importantly, loving yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, you know, right around the same time that your book came out, my book, Tell Me More, came out. And one of the ideas in that is that if you race in to solve someone else's problem in under the banner of like being a loving, supportive friend, mother, spouse, whatever the fill in the blank is, it's almost in a way kind of greedy, because one of life's great pleasures and also an incredibly soothing truth about us is that we do often figure out how to get ourselves out of the hole. And if I figure it out for you, then I'm stealing the joy and the pride and the satisfaction and the comfort that comes from being able to solve problems as they emerge in our lives.
Right. That's exactly what I see in the therapy room all the time. And that's why I, as a therapist, don't give advice, even on my podcast, Dear Therapist, right? So we give advice, but it's advice that's based on something that they have discovered on their own during the session. So we go through one therapy session with them on the podcast where you hear it, and then we give them a week to go try out our suggestion. But again, the suggestion is something that comes directly from something they've discovered about themselves in that hour. And so I think it's really important to remember that when people come for therapy or when your loved ones come to you with something, that they have the answer. They might not think they have the answer, or they might not have arrived at the answer yet, but it's somewhere in there. And if you don't give that voice inside of them enough volume and you talk over it and they get lots of people in their ear, they're not going to hear their own voice, and they're going to choose something or pick a direction that doesn't feel true to them.
Do you have like a magic question that you ask? Like a thing I've been trying to say is, what do you think you're going to do about that? Like that's how I protect myself from saying, well, you should just call her back. Just call her back and say that you would like to babysit after all, and you got a negative COVID test and you need the money. And what, you know, just say, what are you thinking about doing? And I feel like I say it so much that now I have to kind of disguise it in my interactions with my family, lest they feel like I'm therapying them, you know? So I have to like really sell it when I ask, like, so that's weird, huh? Have you thought of anything? What are you gonna do?
Yeah,
Do you have
exactly. I mean, I
questions that
think
you
if we
ask?
were, well, yeah, I do. And I think, I remember when I was training to be a therapist, one of my clinical supervisors said, you have two ears and one mouth. There's a reason for that ratio. So I think that the fewer words that we use, the better. So I will literally say something as short as, say more. Tell me more, like your book. Say more, or oh, really? Just something like that. And I'm very present in the conversation. It's not just a word that I'm throwing out there. I'm responding to them, but I'm in their space with them. I'm in the trench with them. And I think that that is much more effective, because then they do have more to say. They weren't done. Sometimes when you think someone is done talking, or even they think that they're done talking, they're not. They need someone to say to them, oh, interesting, say more, or what do you mean, or tell me more about that.
Yeah, and there's I in some ways there's nothing more loving than the follow-up question.
Yes. The
So, but a
follow-up
thing
question
you
that is.
talk about a lot is perspective taking. So
Yes,
can you spell that
yes.
out a little bit, and like how would that work between two people?
So much of what I see happen is somebody comes in with something that happens between them and someone else, and they have what they think is the accurate version of the story. And yet we're all unreliable narrators. We all tell stories through a particular lens. And so, what we leave in, what we leave out, the parts of the story that we maximize, the parts of the story that we minimize, the things we emphasize, and our role in it, and how we describe what actually happened. We're very unreliable, and we're leaving out an entire perspective that the other person would bring if they were in the room. So what's interesting is that when I see couples, I get to hear both perspectives. And it's sometimes very surprising to the other person that, oh, wow, I can't believe you saw it that way. I had no idea you saw it that way. And all of these motives or reasons that you did what you did that I attributed to you were completely wrong. But we don't ask. We don't really consider the other perspective, because we feel hurt, or we feel wronged, or we just make assumptions about the other person. So I think perspective taking is so important. And in my podcast, that's an exercise that we give people all the time. And you see how quickly that one intervention can really shift a dynamic between people that has been a dynamic where people have been stuck for a very long time. And then they come on Dear Therapist, and all of a sudden they do this perspective taking thing, and they see the world and the other person completely differently. It's such an easy thing to do, but we don't think to do it. So it's kind of like, well, why do you think, why do you think your mom did that? Why do you think your daughter isn't talking to you, right? Why do you think that your partner said that? Why do you think this person is acting that way? What would have to be happening for them that they would react in that way? And those are the questions that you can ask yourself. And if you can write the same story that you just told me, but completely from what you imagine their perspective is, without all of the stuff you just told me, but write it completely from their perspective only. You don't have to agree with their perspective, but imagine what their perspective might be. A whole different world opens up.
Well, that goes to this idea that I remember someone telling me 20 years ago, which is that the number one thing that people want, more than fame, more than money, more than sex, more than a great figure, is to feel they've been felt. And that yes. It's our job to make sure not only that we are feeling them, but that they can feel us feeling them. And the only convincing way to do that is to say, listen, I'm sure that when I showed up 25 minutes late, you were sitting there thinking, I can't fucking believe this. I ran out of the place. I took a shower as fast as I could. I hung up a call early. I didn't talk to my mom just so I could be ready to leave. And now you're here 20 minutes late. And as soon as I say that, then you know, you, whoever this imaginary person is who's mad at me for being late, you know that I know what it feels like, what's going on for you. But that requires this amazing, like, top of the mountain kind of characteristic, which is intellectual humility. Like, you have to believe there are things you don't know and don't understand such that you can underwrite curiosity.
Yes, curiosity is such a key word here. And I think that what happens is the reason people aren't curious is because of shame. Is that when you show up late like that, the first thing that happens is you want to defend yourself because you're ashamed of the fact that, yeah, you should have left earlier, right? You had control over this, maybe. Maybe you didn't. But, you know, often what happens is we want to defend ourselves because we can't distinguish between I did something and I'm sorry for it versus I'm bad. And some people feel like they don't know how to apologize or say that they're sorry for something because they feel like if they acknowledge that they did something that hurt someone else, that it doesn't mean that they did something that maybe they wish they hadn't done. It means that they are something that they wish they weren't. And that's where shame comes in. So I think that it's really important what you said is to be able to connect with somebody and your shame will dissipate and they will appreciate it. They will appreciate that you see them, you understand their perspective as well. And it diffuses the whole situation. That, like, that showing up late example is, you know, those are the kinds of very small things that become very big over time in relationships.
You know, it's funny. I'm thinking about, I have a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old. And so I've been lied to a few times. And when it has happened, I have this ridiculous reaction, which is, I can't believe that you looked me in the eye and told a bold-faced lie. Like, I'm appalled. And that's really kind of shamey. And it's not very humble or honest because I lied my face off to my mother when I was 17 and 19 years old.
Right.
And so then I always feel like I have to go back to them and say, can I tell you, I hit it a little hard there on the lying thing. Like, I lied to my parents all the time from like age 15 to 22. So I'm sorry. I was acting like you were the only person ever to lie. And of course, that's not true.
Right. And the question is,
we can actually make them shame. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And I think the question there in that moment is to say, and it's really hard as a parent. So of course I'm saying this from the comfort of not being faced with that in this moment, but it's really important to just take a breath and imagine what it's like to be your child or your teenager at that moment. And to say to them, what made it so hard for you to tell me the truth? What did you think would happen if you had told me the truth? And that's where the really good conversation is going to happen. And sometimes parents think, well, if I don't, you know, make it really clear from the very first thing out of my mouth that lying is wrong and don't you dare lie to me and how can I ever trust you again, that they're not going to get the lesson. They're going to get the lesson a lot better if you start with, I'm trying to understand, I know you're a really honest person. I'm trying to understand what made you afraid to tell me the truth here.
That's brilliant. I mean, that alone, that's like my takeaway for the day. And also specifically what you said is, I know that you're an honest person. Mm-hmm. And so there must be, but you know, that goes to fear. Like, I feel like fear plays a big role in these human interactions, because what I'm afraid of is either I'm going to do the moment wrong as a parent, so I'm going to make for more lying. Or I'm afraid that if I give an inch, they're going to take a mile.
Right, right.
And what's beyond all that fear is this chance for an actual conversation where it's like, well, I'll tell you why I didn't tell you. Because the last time I told you something in that category, you went bananas. And it was like a whole 3-day thing. And so I didn't want to go through that.
Right. And that's really good to know. I think what happens is we create entire stories around, you know, my kid lied. Oh my God, my kid's going to go to jail. You know, like one day, like it starts here, you know, this was the gateway. This is the gateway into a life of, you know, failure or whatever it is. And so we get, you know, these little moments become very big to us. Like, I can't believe my child is lying. What does this mean? It happens very quickly in our heads. We don't even know what's happening. Like, oh my gosh, who is this person? Who did this person become? Who did I raise? And what's going to happen to this child? Whereas really, like you said, it's probably mom doesn't react well to, she can't handle the truth. I can't trust her to handle my truth. And if I could trust her to handle my truth, I would be a lot more honest with her.
Right. I mean, I do feel like parenting in general is either, I never know if I'm overreacting or underreacting. You know, like the fear is that if I don't come down with a hammer on this thing, that they're going to go to jail.
Right.
Or if I, but then there's also the very real possibility that if you hit it too hard, you're going to create this shame cycle. And shame is really big, right? Isn't shame like the most problematic?
Yeah. And kids internalize it. So think of all of us as adults and the voice in our own heads. Where did that voice come from? For a lot of us, we are so hard on ourselves. I had a patient who did not believe me when I was noticing how self-critical she was. And I said, I want you to go home and write down everything that that voice in your head says to you over the course of a few days and come back and tell me what happened. And she came back and she said, I can't even read this. I am such a bully to myself. And when we talk about shame, there were things like she made a typo on an email and she had said to herself, you're such an idiot, right? For that, she caught her reflection. She caught her reflection in a mirror and said, oh, you look terrible today. You know, the way that we talk to ourselves, we are not kind. And so I always say, is it kind? Is it true? Is it useful? And if it's not, where's that voice coming from? You weren't born with that voice. Where is that voice coming from? And for us to really listen to that voice and adjust it, not only when we're talking to our kids or our partners or our friends or our siblings or our parents, but especially when we're talking to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I wanna get to some takeaways. So the first is what you're saying right now, which is that self-compassion, like being decent to yourself, talking to yourself in a way that wouldn't make another person cry.
That's right, that's right. Yes, and knowing too that we talk to ourselves more than we talk to anybody else in the course of our lives. So whenever I ask people, who's the person you talk to most in the course of your life? Most people think it's their partner, their parent, their sibling, their best friend. It's yourself. So that voice is going all the time. Make sure that it, whatever that voice says, is kind and true and useful.
Kind, true, useful. And then the second one you said at the very top, which is that there's kind of a taboo around vulnerability and it's deeply misunderstood as weakness. And there's a lot of people trying to get us to understand that, but persist, it does.
It does persist. And I will say that when I see couples and women will say to their husbands, if it's a heterosexual couple, you know, I really want to know more about your inner life. I really want to understand you. And he opens up to her and he starts crying. She often is stuck in this place of, I don't feel safe when you don't open up to me, but I don't feel safe when you are this vulnerable with me. And so that is a cultural message that we have as women, we have to watch out for as much as men do.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one is this idea of like listening and perspective taking. Like that's a real unlocking move.
Absolutely. I think that once you start to imagine that there's more than one version of a story, you know, the story can go in all kinds of different directions. It frees you up and it helps you to navigate your relationship so much more smoothly.
Yeah, and it takes a little daring, and so don't be alarmed if it feels terrifying, but, you know, dive in nonetheless. Well, you're such a gift. I love talking to you. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Oh, thank you so much, Kelly. I always love talking with you.